Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and happy Friday, everybody. And because it's Friday, let's jump right into our week in review and talk a bit about the big stories of the past few days. To help us do that, we're joined by Renee Graham, columnist for the Boston Globe. And Renee, great to see you.
Hi, Anthony.
And John Carroll, professor at BU's College of Communications and a senior analyst for WBUR. Always good to have you, John.
Always good to be here.
So let's start with presidential politics and last night's CNN Republican debate. Now, compared to the previous ones that were R-rated and descended deep into the mud, last night's affair was positively G-rated as the four candidates spent a couple of hours debating policy. So here's the front runner, Donald Trump.
We're all in this together. We're going to come up with solutions. We're going to find the answers to things. And so far, I cannot believe how civil it's been up here.
So, Renee and John, you know, I was reminded watching last night to sort of paraphrase Rodney Dangerfield, I tuned in expecting a fight and a political debate broke out. I don't know. What did you think, John? What did you see last night?
Yeah, I thought it was different, a totally different approach. Instead, they decided to go insult-free for the most part, but they also went sort of fact-free for the most part. There was a lot of misleading information that was being tossed around up there.
What stood out to you as something that needed to be truth squatted and corrected?
Everything that Donald Trump said needed to be truth squatted. that's a pretty much of a constant all the way through. One of the interesting things was this was supposed to be a substantive debate, and it just demonstrated how few factual propositions Donald Trump brings to this primary contest. He has virtually no policy positions at all. Mm. And the ones he has, he just makes up on the fly. He's constantly contradicting himself. So essentially, he's content-free for the most part.
Yeah. Well, Renee, I guess there was sort of a strategic decision by the other three. I mean, Kasich, of course, hadn't been participating, but on the part of Ted Cruz and particularly Marco Rubio, I guess a sort of calculated decision not to go after him.
Well, look, you can't out-Trump Donald Trump.
Yeah.
You know, they tried that. It didn't work. So the whole idea was just like, we're going to just, you know, do our thing. We're going to talk about what our policies such as they are and, you know, for what they are. And we're not going to go after Donald Trump because it simply doesn't work. They had to take a different tack because it hasn't proven successful so far.
Yeah. And it hasn't proven successful because I mean, my thought when they sort of descended into the mud and really went after him in the previous debates, it seems like they were essentially relinquishing their advantage and playing on his terms.
Well, being high-minded got them nowhere.
Yeah.
So for a few weeks, they decide, okay, we're going to get in the mud and we're going to sling it just like he does. But you, as I said, you can't out-Trump him. You can't out-insult him. And it just made them look bad. And it just made the whole process just go deeper and deeper and become more unbearable for a lot of people. You know, you're not going to change minds about Donald Trump. The people who want to support Donald Trump are going to do it. You can't say it by, but you can't do it by trying to come up with really unattractive things to say about him or talking about his appearance. It just the last few weeks were just terrible. Mm. So last night was kind of a correction.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to ask you about that. And I mean, I'd love to get both of your responses because it seems like, I mean, John, and just sort of get back to your point about Donald Trump playing loose with the facts or his proposals lacking policy specifics. I mean, it seems like on the one hand, you've got some candidates who are talking about policies. Donald Trump is talking about a feeling more than policies.
Right. His people don't really care what he has to say. They care how he says it.
Yeah.
That's the important thing to them. And, you know, he's going out there with an attitude that is an attitude that plays right into the sentiments that most of his supporters have. So it works for him up to a point. If you look at the delegate count, he's hit the ceiling. He's got a 35% ceiling. He may have a 35% floor, too, for all we know.
Mm.
But essentially, he's been trying to move to the more general election tone of voice in the last couple of debates, trying to moderate some of his rhetoric. It was hard when he was being attacked from all sides the previous debate, but this one again. I mean, he's talking about uniting. He's talking about trying to be more diplomatic in the way he approaches it. I think he realizes that, you know, this lack of a presidential quality to a lot of what the Republican primary candidates have brought to this process. I think that he knows that that's going to hurt him
but,
in the end.
But at the same time, he changes his tone, but there's still no substance.
Mm-hmm.
So he's still saying the exact same things, but he's saying it in a much more measured and what he perceives to be a presidential tone. So again, it's like the idea is that he can somehow bring people in by not yelling or insulting everyone. It doesn't matter if you're actually looking for, you know, real policy and real substance.
I want to ask you both about Marco Rubio, who seems to be approaching his sort of last stand, his Alamo, as he goes into the Florida primary next Tuesday. He, as we've discussed, was among the candidates who was not attacking Donald Trump last night. So let's listen to a little bit of him. This is courtesy of CNN.
I know that a lot of people find appeal in the things Donald says because he says what people wish they could say. The problem is presidents can't just say anything they want. It has consequences here and around the world. I can also tell you that if you go to any national cemetery, especially Arlington, you're going to see crescent moons there. If you go anywhere in the world, you're going to see American men and women serving us in uniform that are Muslims. And they love America.
So I'd love to get both of your responses to this. I mean, Marco Rubio has sort of gone from this almost anointed favorite of many party regulars to the guy who got in the mud with Donald Trump. And then last night, he's sort of sounding eloquent and presidential again. I mean, I had whiplash.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he's basically substituted a chiropractor for his campaign manager at this point because he's all over the place. He doesn't know where to go, what to do, who to be, and this is causing him problems. And it's Trump who's done it to him. But there was a report out today that some of his campaign people are telling supporters in Ohio to vote for John Kasich. He knows that the only way he has any chance of this working out well for him is if Trump loses one or the other, Florida or Ohio. And he knows that that he has less of a chance in Florida than Kasich has in Ohio. So strategically, it plays right into what Mitt Romney was talking about in one of his more lucid moments when he went on his anti-Trump jihad.
You know, in lieu of being the nominee, he's going to be the spoiler.
Mm-hmm.
So his communications director is saying exactly what John said. He's telling people, you know, vote for Kasich. That's how we stop Trump. So it's more of a stop Trump, not, you know, let's get Marco on the board. It's we need to stop Trump. So I think because maybe Rubio still thinks that gives him a chance at the convention. I don't know what his thinking is in that, but it's just an extraordinary thing to hear a candidate, you know, team telling people, vote for this guy. Don't even vote for us. Vote for that guy because we need to stop Trump.
But if you look at the numbers just real quickly, I mean, if Trump wins Florida and Ohio, he needs to win 52% of the remaining delegates. If he loses Ohio and wins Florida, he needs 59. If he loses both of them, he needs 69% of the delegates.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is about the only way this turns out badly for Donald Trump.
Interesting. Well, John, you mentioned Mitt Romney's, I'll phrase it slightly differently, but his stop Trump effort. And that continued this week. Romney was actually on WBUR's On Point talking about why he's speaking out and trying to stop Trump at all costs. Here's a bit of what he said.
A candidate who equivocated about Ku Klux Klan, who disparaged Mexican Americans as rapists, who categorized all Muslims in the world, what, 1.5 billion of them, as not being right to come to the country. I just felt that at some point I had to make it very clear where I stood.
Now, we spoke to some folks this week in Massachusetts, Trump supporters, and asked them about how they feel about folks like Romney and other establishment Republicans trying to stop Trump. So here's State Representative Jeff Deal. He's the co-chair of Trump's campaign in Massachusetts.
It seems like they just sort of want to move the goal line. You know, every time Donald Trump shows even greater expansion of his support across the country. So, you know, I think that's a mistake for establishment to do that because it's really angering the base. I mean, Mitt Romney's work has sort of backfired in some ways.
Renee, do you think that, I mean, is he right about that? I mean, has it backfired or what do you think?
Democracy says you're allowed to vote for the worst person out there. And the idea that there's this whole team of people running around saying, no, we have to stop this. No, we have to make sure he's not a candidate. You can't vote for him. It's absurd. People are going to rebel. It reminds me of, you know, years ago in Washington, D.C., when Marion Barry, who was the former mayor, got out of prison and he was running to be mayor again. There was this whole thought that, no, a convicted crack addict can't be mayor. And he won.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he won because a lot of people just said, do not tell us who we can and cannot vote for. That is not the way the system works. So, you know, you bring Mitt Romney, that's your bullpen guy, that's your closer, that's the person who's going to turn this thing around. it was a mistake. And I think it actually was actually a backlash to that this week.
It's interesting, too, John. And one of the things that Romney said in this interview on Point, and he said it elsewhere, is that, you know, he would rather go to a contested convention. And I want to ask you about that, because that seems fraught with risk for Republicans as well. I mean, imagine all the Trump supporters suddenly being deprived of the candidate that they thought they had voted for.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that could be problematic. It will be problematic if it comes to that. But flip it around. The other candidates can make the case that basically 65% of the Republicans don't want you.
True.
And so why not go with the majority who want someone other than you and try to figure out an alternative? I think it's going to be very hard for the Republicans at the convention to take it away from Trump if he's close to the 1237 that you need to win the nomination. I think it's going to be really difficult. And my understanding is that you can't parachute somebody in from the outside. What Mitt Romney said when he was asked, could you be the savior? Could you be the one? He said, my understanding is you need to win at least 8 states to be in contention.
Yeah.
So I think that you get down to the 4 of them. I think Trump the odds are in Trump's favor. But you can make the argument that that the party overall rejected Donald Trump.
But isn't a contested convention really the wacky crescendo
yes.
we all deserve? Won't we all be a little disappointed if we don't get that?
Well, it's true. This season has provided so many things that could not have been predicted a few months ago. So, of course, it has to be a contested. I mean, by that sort of model of things, it's got to be
I think the American people deserve that at this point.
Well, can we vote on that?
Yeah, right. It doesn't matter. It's going to happen anyway. Okay. So I want to move on and talk about the Democrats. They debated twice this week, including in Michigan, just ahead of that state's primary. Now, compared to last night's gentle Republican exchange of views, the Democrats actually got mad at each other. Here's a moment when Hillary Clinton launched an attack on Bernie Sanders about who did the most to save the auto industry.
I voted to save the auto industry. He voted against the money that ended up saving the auto industry.
Oh.
I think that is a pretty big difference.
Well, if you are talking about the Wall Street bailout, where some of your friends destroyed this economy,
you know,
I'm talking.
Let him sprung.
All right. So Hillary Clinton was called out by called to task by a few of that for that line of attack. I mean, suggesting that Sanders voted against the rescue of the auto industry. But I mean, when you listen to that exchange, I guess it shows there's a lot at stake in this race. What did you hear, Renee?
Well, I heard two things. You know, there's a sense that Hillary Clinton has that maybe this is slipping away a little bit and she's got to really step up her game. She can't just show up and win this thing. So I think that she's fighting a lot harder. But the other thing you hear in that clip, of course, is, you know, the unfortunate Bernie Sanders moment. You know, excuse me, I'm talking.
Right, right.
Uncomfortable, awkward, wasn't a good moment. It was, you know, I think that for the most part, Sanders' politics are in the right place, but it sounded really dismissive, you know, and it hit a lot of women in particular in a very funny kind of way.
I understand.
But it does show just how feisty this thing has become because, you know, no one could have predicted 6 months ago we would still be talking about Bernie Sanders at this point, you know, and he sees daylight at this point.
I want to ask you both about this surprise win in Michigan, because all of the polling suggested that Sanders was going to lose, even Nate Silver's polling. And so, you know, a couple of questions about this. Sanders supporters have been saying that the pundits and journalists like us have been too quick to declare this race over. Are they right, John?
Absolutely. Bernie Sanders has made much more of a race out of this than anybody ever expected he could have. And I think Bernie Sanders, if he looks back, he will regret not being more aggressive earlier. I understand what Renee means about him sort of bulldozing Hillary Clinton in that conversation. However, if he had been more aggressive early on, if he had not taken the emails, her emails controversy off the table as early as he did, this would be, I think it would be a much closer race than it is now. I think that he has found the weaknesses in Hillary Clinton that the Republicans will also exploit going into the general election. And I think she is just
if she
not,
gets there.
If she, if, right. she's just not a good candidate. It's it's painful to watch her because she is the polar opposite of her husband, who was a natural politician. She is an unnatural politician.
And interesting to hear her admitting that this week. So this week, I mean, big primaries in the Midwest, Illinois, Missouri, and of course, Ohio. Hillary Clinton has this huge delegate advantage, but of course, that was drawn largely because of doing so well among African Americans in southern states. So what's at stake this week? It sounds like an awful lot is, right, Renee?
You know,
people keep
saying that, you know, Hillary's too far ahead in the delegate race and Bernie can't possibly catch up. But if he continues to win states, you know, and so defy what the pollsters say. I think that was the most interesting thing to come out of Michigan. There was a sense that, well, she's winning this backwards, so why is he even showing up? And he won. So it says a lot about what the pollsters don't understand about the way the voters are feeling. Mm-hmm. And to spring off something that John said earlier, you know, about Bernie Sanders having made a difference earlier, if he had been quicker to embrace the black community. You know, last summer he was really sort of fighting against, you know, there were Black Lives Matter protesters who were showing up at some of his campaign events, and he was really fighting against that and being a little gruff with it. If he had understood that earlier and how important getting young blacks, older blacks on his side to make his point clean to them, you know, this could be a very different race at this point, and he might not have lost some of the states that he did.
Well, I want to move on because I want to make sure we've got some time to talk about some issues that unfolded closer to home this week in Massachusetts. So let's move on to some state politics. Yesterday, the state Senate unanimously passed comprehensive opioid legislation. The day after, the House did the same thing. Governor Baker is expected to sign the legislation early next week. The bill includes provisions such as limiting first-time opioid prescriptions to a 7-day supply, requiring schools to establish programs for screening students for signs of substance abuse. What do you both think of this legislation? Does it go far enough, John?
No, well, not for Charlie Baker, it doesn't. Charlie Baker wanted a lot more.
Yeah, among other things, he wanted to have mandatory 72-hour holding period for addicts. That is, doctors could basically say you got to stay in the hospital for 72 hours.
Right, and he wanted to limit prescriptions to 3 days rather than 7 days. But I think that he's happy to get anything at this point, and I think that he'll sign this no problem. He'll wish he had gotten the whole loaf, but he'll be content with the half loaf. I think there are still problematic things here. I think that there is not enough attention paid to the financial aspect of this. Where's the money going to come from? And interestingly, the Senate down in D.C. just passed an opioid bill yesterday, and that also doesn't have any money attached to it. So you wonder, you know, how effective these things can be. I think they're well-meaning. I wonder how effective they're going to be. And also the law enforcement aspect of this. People aren't really talking about this. This is not just about people who have extra Percocet left over in their prescriptions. I mean, there is a thriving industry of drug dealing that goes on that contributes to this problem, and I really haven't seen much of that. But I think it's a good step. It's a step in the right direction.
It's a good start.
Yeah, it's a start.
It's a good start. And it's an important start. What I do find interesting is it really how far we've come since the 1980s, when the solution to rampant drug use essentially was to build prisons and fill them as quickly as possible, usually with black and brown people. If they had taken the tact that they're using now, if they'd used that 30 years ago, we wouldn't be having conversations now about mass incarceration.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that decides that you're not going to continually criminalize people who are struggling with addiction is a good thing. It doesn't go far enough, but as I said, it's an important first step.
We had Boston Mayor Marty Walsh on the show. He expressed some reservations about the student screening portion of the bill, specifically about the cost. John, you mentioned where does the money come from? The scope of the cost of establishing screening protocols. Here's a bit of what he said.
It's a good idea, but I don't know how it's going to get carried out. I think it's very difficult. For example, the city of Boston, if we had to screen every high school, we'd have to create a whole new division in every single school to be able to do this.
So that sounds like a real concern.
It is a concern, and there are also privacy issues here. I think it's going to happen in two different grades. They haven't designated which grades those will be yet. But I think that there is the possibility of a real invasion of student privacy here. I think it could be handled well and could be handled sensitively. I don't know that it necessarily won't be, but I think that there are issues here of how far do you go with this to try to determine who is prone to addiction, who is struggling with addiction, who is not. And I think that that's a real sort of minefield for the schools to be dealing with. It just raises so many sensitive issues that I think if they're not really careful with it, it could really backfire and be counterproductive in many ways.
And you don't also don't want to stigmatize kids. You know, I've done nothing. Why are you testing me? You don't want to make kids feel like criminals. I think it's a really slippery slope. I understand why this is part of it and why they want to do it, but I think actually carrying it out is going to be very, very different and very difficult.
It's important to understand, though. I mean, if I understand this, the student screening portion of this bill, it wouldn't actually be a test. It would be an interview. Right. Essentially, you would be talking to students about looking for risky behavior, and that they actually have the option to opt out of it if they or their parents don't want to do it. But still, your point.
Once you opt out, then what does that say?
Right.
Then it becomes the what do you have to hide?
Right. Yeah,
just
exactly.
Just asking questions. I think I just think it's going to be a really tricky thing to pull off.
The other drug story on Beacon Hill this week, a hearing held by the Joint Committee on the Judiciary on a ballot initiative to legalize recreational marijuana sales. And two big questions came out of this. Is this a good idea? And of course, one of our questions is, will voters approve it? Now, Governor Baker, Mayor Walsh, and Attorney General Maura Healey published a joint op-ed in the Boston Globe this week opposing legalizing recreational marijuana. They cited concerns of young people getting access to marijuana as one of their chief concerns. Here again is Mayor Walsh on Radio Boston talking about this.
I get concerned around the marijuana discussion because, particularly around young people, they're more likely to use marijuana where it's legal. And I know that the Senate went out and did a study out in Colorado, and certainly they found some concerns.
What do you think? Renee, I'll start with you. I mean, there's an interesting timing here. On the one hand, we're dealing with an opioid addiction crisis. On the other hand, we're sort of, we're about to ramp up this debate about legalizing recreational marijuana. Seems like some dissonance there.
Well, look, for years, marijuana was seen as this gateway drug. If you do weed, you're going to do other things. People don't look at it that way anymore. In the way that it's been decriminalized in lots of different states, the way it can be sold legally in other states, I don't think people compare what's happening with opioids to the possibility of allowing marijuana sales. I'd be interested to see the numbers. What are the numbers on young people increasingly doing weed because it's available? I think kids are doing weed anyway. But,
right. Well, this is a great point. In fact, we had another guest on the show this week, Dr. Kevin Hill. He is an addiction specialist at McLean Hospital, and he said on Tuesday that concerns about skyrocketing drug use are overblown. Here's what he said.
It is fair to say that since marijuana has been legalized in Colorado, the use has gone up. However, use was already going up. So we've seen time and time again, and this has been in published reports, frankly, both with medical marijuana and legalization of marijuana, that those policies don't change the rate of increase.
What's your view on this, John?
I don't know if his numbers are right or not. I know there are a lot of conflicting numbers out there in terms of the science, in terms of what happened in Colorado. The report that came out from the traveling lawmakers who went out to Colorado and garnered this headline in High Times magazine, to which I do not subscribe, by the way. Massachusetts senator shows he is clueless about marijuana during Colorado visit. Their report that came back would make the law that the legislature would pass if this ballot question passes and forces them to, so restrictive and so expensive. Mm. I mean, part of the idea here of legalizing recreational marijuana is to try to minimize the black market. The number of taxes that they propose putting on the sale of marijuana in Massachusetts would probably increase the black market as opposed to limit it. So I think there are all kinds of problems. I think if you look at Colorado, it has not been a disaster. I think there are ways that that they could use and modify what Colorado has done to do something intelligent here.
Mm. There's an endorsement. It has not been a disaster.
Yeah. Well,
this obviously is going to become a huge debate. It's going to be on the ballot in November. So, as I said, this is going to ramp up in a big way. So, folks, we've got time for our hubbubs, those stories that didn't make it above the fold this week, and we want to make sure we got time to talk about them. John, your
my hubbub has to do with Donald Trump and the game of golf.
Aha.
Yes. Donald Trump goes around talking about how many championships he's won. If you plug Trump cheats golf into Google, you get over 500,000 search results. But a local sports writer has come to his rescue. Boston Globe scribe Michael Whitmer wrote a column yesterday talking about Donald Trump. He has a 3 handicap. He has indeed won championships at clubs, and he owns 17 of them. And he also got the first hole-in-one on a new course that he just opened in the Bronx. So I think that his honor was upheld by the Boston Globe yesterday very nicely in terms of the game of golf.
Well, thank heavens for that, both for Donald Trump and the game of golf. Renee, you're up.
I want to be really clear here. I'm not endorsing. I'm not encouraging trespassing.
Okay.
However, someone did sneak into the still being renovated government station, T station, and took pictures. And of course, as people do, posted them. The station is gorgeous. It's light and bright. You know, the old government center T station looked like a horror movie dungeon.
That's a good point.
It was dank and dark and super creepy. So, you know, at a time when the NBA is really under siege, you know, this actually is an odd PR move for them. You know, it lets people have a feeling of where their fare increases
now
are actually going.
Remind us, when does the station open? Do we know?
The 21st of this month.
The 21st of this month, coming soon.
Right. We can go get our own pictures.
A brand new government center T stop.
But we got a little preview, a little amuse-bouche, if you will, of the station.
Well, my hubbub concerns the food fight between the Boston Globe's Nestor Ramos and the historic Union Oyster House at 190 years old, one of America's oldest restaurants, if not the oldest. But in a review, Ramos pans it badly as a rundown tourist trap where overpriced food is an afterthought. That prompted a stinging rebuke from the restaurant's bar manager, Jim Sullivan, who accuses Ramos of unfairly hitting the famous Boston restaurant with a blindsided journalistic sucker punch with a side of snark. So you can find links to Nestor's Ramos's review, see if you agree, and the response from the Union Oyster House's bar manager, and weigh in yourself on this Boston food fight. So that's
maybe we can get an invite to be the tiebreaker.
There you go. Sounds good. I can always use a bowl of chowder. John Carroll, professor of communication at Boston University and WBUR senior news analyst. John, thanks.
Thank you.
And Renee Graham, columnist for the Boston Globe. Renee, always great to have you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Anthony.
Stay with us, listeners. There's more ahead. This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.